This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the metaversal thought capsule where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, we want to know what's happening with cryptocurrencies in the week after $200 billion was wiped off the value of the market. Was it a big blip or the bursting of the bubble? Crypto means hidden or secret, and we all know what currency means. What isn't a secret about cryptocurrency is that last week it suffered what some described as its Black Wednesday moment. Investors fell over each other to withdraw their funds, and more than $200 billion was wiped off the cryptocurrency market. One currency, ironically of a type known as stablecoin, lost 98% of its value. But was this a solitary, if for some very costly, blip? Or is the cryptocurrency market a classic bubble in danger of bursting? And would it matter if it did? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. In a minute, we'll look into what caused last week's crash and ask what it all means. But before we do, the briefing room's Rosamund Jones spoke to Gavin Brown, Associate Professor in Financial Technology at the University of Liverpool, and she started by asking him a simple question.
Gavin, what is cryptocurrency?
It is a money which is controlled and issued by something other than a nation state. In other words, it's not controlled by a government or a central bank.
And can you give me a brief history of crypto? I mean, when did it first start?
It's very short in history, really. I mean, there's been many attempts to create what we might know as a digital money over the recent decades. But the very first digital money to work, or internet money, was Bitcoin. That was theorized in Q3 2008 as a direct response to the financial crisis. And since that point, and the 12 or 13 years since, lots of volatility in price, ups and downs, currently in a down.
Are the two terms interchangeable, crypto and Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is one example of cryptocurrency. It's the first one that worked, and indeed it's the most valuable as well. But it's not the only one. There are, in fact, and I'll just check my screen now, 19,464 other cryptocurrencies that presently have a positive market value. So it's a very crowded space, especially when you compare that to fiat currencies, that is, you know, pounds and euros and dollars, etc., of which globally there are just 180.
And how many people use or invest cryptocurrency? Do we have any idea?
The number varies by geography. It also varies by demographic as well. But here in the UK, the Financial Conduct Authority put an estimate out in June of last year to estimate that between 3.9% and 4.4% of all UK adults have either owned or used cryptocurrency.
And why are they using it?
A lot of those people will be buying cryptocurrency as a speculative asset, which means they're not buying to use it as a currency. They're buying because they think that it will go up in price and they're keen to make profit from that price increase. Whether that's because they understand the technology or because they're following other people who have made money or believed to have made money, that would be obviously difficult to say. But in terms of the fundamental technology, it does have some very unique features. Lots of weaknesses as well, but some unique features too. So for instance, Bitcoin is finite in supply, which means there will only be ever 21 million Bitcoins that can be created. That can be quite appealing in a world of quantitative easing. So with our increased indebtedness and increasing amount of currency in circulation, which can actually cause our currencies to get weaker, cryptocurrency doesn't really suffer from that problem. In fact, it is limited by supply, which in some people's eyes make it more appealing as well.
You talked about the weaknesses of cryptocurrency. Can you just give me some idea of what you think those are?
Carbon footprint, the sustainability of cryptocurrency. Bitcoin in isolation uses between 0.25% and 0.5% of all global electricity. Other things that would be of issue would be the lack of regulation or certainly different regulatory regimes. We have the likes of China who have banned cryptocurrency. We have Switzerland who are very much pro-cryptocurrency with a positive environment. And then here in the UK, we're probably somewhere between the two, but maybe slightly leaning on the more positive side.
What percentage of the world's money is actually held in cryptocurrency?
If you were to make a big pile of all the money in the world and a big pile of all the cryptocurrency in the world, mainstream money is around about 1,000 times bigger by aggregate valuation. Quite often you'll hear people say, you know, cryptocurrency gets a lot of airtime and yet it doesn't pose a systemic threat to the financial system. And that's simply because of its size. However, one thing which is very much on people's radars is how quickly cryptocurrency has grown. I know it doesn't feel like it, but 10 years or 13 years really is actually a very short period of time. So at this present moment, or at the peak, should I say, of Bitcoin, it was actually worth more than the Swiss franc. It was worth about 20% of the value of pound sterling. That is a meteoric rise. And therefore, it's very much on the radar of central banks and policymakers.
Can you explain in what ways it doesn't work as a standard currency?
A currency should be stable in value. It should be a standard unit of account, and you should have faith that the currency value in real terms tomorrow is roughly similar to what it is today. And if that's not the case, then that volatility means that you can't have faith to transact or run businesses and transactions using that currency. And that's probably the key reason. Most of the other tenets of what currency is, it can satisfy in terms of it's fungible, which means you can exchange one for the other. It's separable. In other words, you can divide them up and transact between different counterparties. So all of these things it can do, but that volatility point is a key problem.
Rosamund Jones talking to Gavin Brown. So what set off last week's crypto turmoil and how much should we worry about it? Joining me in the briefing room are Jemima Kelly, columnist at the Financial Times, and Dominic Frisby, a columnist at Money Week and author of Bitcoin, the Future of Money. Dominic Frisby, let's talk about the market for cryptocurrency before the crash. What had been happening?
Well, you find that Bitcoin and crypto in general tend to go through phases, cycles. And you'll see a sort of quiet accumulation phase where nobody's interested. Then you'll see a sort of noisy blow off top when it's all over the media and the price is spiking. And then you'll see one of these monster corrections. And then you sort of go into a sort of frustrating consolidation where the price goes nowhere. And Bitcoin had had one of its monster runs last year up to $60,000. And then it had had one of its typical cyclical corrections. This one was, in inverted commas, only 50%. In previous cycles, they've been about 80%. So it was in a period of frustrating consolidation, if you like. And then we got this Terra story. If I can briefly explain that, Terra is what's called a stable coin. And the idea of stable coins is that they replicate the US dollar or the pound or the euro, whichever government currency we're talking about. And the reason, the purpose for them is as trading vehicles. And in theory, a company can only issue as many stable coins as it has US dollars in the bank. A bit like in the old days of the gold standard, the government could only print as much money as it had gold to back it. But these whiz kids at Terra had decided that they were going to invent a new kind of stable coin that was based on algorithms rather than on how much US dollars they actually had. And it turned out their algorithm was flawed. This was exposed by various traders in the market, and the value of Terra plunged. And as a result, this created a liquidity crisis, and this created a panic across the crypto markets, and Bitcoin fell. And I'm delighted to say that even though Bitcoin fell briefly, it's bounced back very strongly, and it's only a couple of thousand dollars off where it was when this crisis began.
So, Jemima Kelly, this is the picture, which is that you do have fluctuations. You have periods when everybody's terribly keen on it, everybody's talking about it, cryptocurrency rises in value, then periods of consolidation, people get bored with it, and then you get something like this, which is a very specific kind of crash as a result of the things that Dominic's been talking about. Is that essentially the picture as you see it?
No, I would characterize it a little bit differently. I think Dominic's take is that it's very much kind of, you know, goes up, comes down a little, consolidates. I guess he would say that it would kind of keep on just going up, and ultimately it would kind of be an upward trajectory with some little blips. I'm not sure that we know for sure that that's what will carry on in the future. That's kind of, we might have seen that in the past. In my opinion, the whole kind of space is ultimately a bubble. And so at some point, it could just all kind of collapse, like, you know, and the bubble could burst. So I'm not sure we can know whether this is just a kind of blip at this point. And just to go back to the state of the market beforehand, so I think Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies had been falling before this crash last week. Bitcoin and the wider crypto market used to be seen as a kind of hedge against inflation, and the fact that it had kind of little correlation to other asset classes meant that that case could be made. But as more and more kind of traditional investors, mainstream investors have kind of got into the market, that is becoming kind of less the case. And you've seen that in the last few months, that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have moved much more in step with other markets. And these cryptocurrencies have behaved much more like traditional kind of risk assets, as they're called. So these are the assets like stocks and commodities that you buy when you are feeling quite confident about the economy. Now, obviously, because we've had the Russian invasion of Ukraine, people are worried about a recession. We've got inflation spiking in many countries. We are now in a kind of risk off scenario. And Bitcoin, having kind of in some ways matured to be seen as this slightly more, I mean, it's still clearly not a traditional asset in any description of that word, but it's seen much more as a risk asset than any kind of uncorrelated asset. And so therefore it started to move slightly more in tandem with traditional kind of riskier assets.
Dominic, is that the way you see it as well, essentially, which is that what you've got is a form of investor behavior now in cryptocurrency, which is not totally unlike other forms of investor behavior in other forms of stock?
Oh, the psychologies of people investing in cryptocurrency are the same as people speculating in any market anywhere, only more pronounced. It's probably the only free market, totally free market in the whole world. There's no regulation or very little regulation once you get into the ecosystem itself. I would say, what is a bubble? This is an important thing. People dismiss Bitcoin as a bubble. But those who dismiss Bitcoin almost invariably do not own it and have never owned it. A bubble is a bull market in which you don't have a position. It's very easy to just go, oh, it's a bubble, and justify your decision for not investing in it. In reality, Bitcoin may be down 50% from its highs or 60% from its highs. It's still up 10 times where it was 2 years ago. It's up 100 times where it was 5 years ago. And it's up 10,000 times where it was 10 years ago. Now, Bitcoin is a new technology. And the purpose of this new technology is to be an alternate system of money. Whether it's dot-com or railways in the 19th century, almost every time you get some kind of breakthrough new technology, there's a bubble that surrounds it, a speculative mania. But there may have been a bubble in dot-com, and there may have been loads of stupid companies that emerged in the year 2000, but the internet was very real. Loads of companies may have gone bust after the railways of the 19th century, but railways were very real. So Bitcoin itself works I would distinguish that from other cryptocurrencies and other coins over which they get invented all the time. Some of them are scams. Some of them are idle technological experiments. The whole thing is the Wild West. There are going to be scams. There are going to be invention galore. But that doesn't mean that the underlying technology isn't sound.
Okay. But what we're talking about now, before I come to Jemima, is the question of what it does and confidence in it and in other cryptocurrencies. And the first thing you might say, Jemima, is that Bitcoin actually doesn't function like money. It's supposed to be money, but it doesn't function like it.
Absolutely. I mean, it doesn't fulfill any of the main criteria that money should fulfill. And increasingly, I would call it gambling. It's much more akin to gambling than investing. The whole thing runs completely on belief. And this is why we see these really dramatic collapses when there's a loss of faith. Because in another market, when there's a kind of loss of confidence in the economy or in worries about inflation, worries about geopolitics, there might be a kind of quite pronounced fall, but there is still fundamental things. There are still kind of companies that underlie those stock prices. In the case of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, the whole thing is based on belief. There's nothing other than belief. And so when you have a loss of that belief, the falls are far more pronounced. Yes, of course, if you had invested a few years ago and held on to that, then you would have made a lot of money. Whether or not it's fallen more than half, you would still be holding on to a lot of money. People who got in last year, most of the retail investors who are kind of now in the market, there were some stats to say that 55% of all Bitcoin holders got in 2021. Most of them are going to have lost a lot of money. So obviously the people who got in at the beginning have a huge incentive to keep trying to get more people in, because that's the way this kind of structure works, that you need to keep on recruiting new people into the market in order to keep the price going up. It's not that you can't make money from this. You, of course, can make a lot of money. But when the whole market is based on nothing more than belief, you can also lose a lot of money, as we saw last week.
If it collapses, Dominic, I mean, if it were to actually mean effectively the end of cryptocurrency, off all the confidence would go out of the cryptocurrency market, which you don't expect, but which is possible, would that have any implications for the broader economy?
If the whole cryptocurrency market collapsed and it was decided that there is no future in crypto technology whatsoever, then a lot of people would lose a lot of money, and it might have ramifications for the broader economy. The difference is there are no bailouts in Bitcoin. The idea that Bitcoin is not backed by anything but belief is flawed. It's backed by tons and tons of computer processing power and mathematical proof. That's why people are so excited about it. It is a technological breakthrough. It has a hash rate in the quintillions. It is backed by mathematical proof. Nobody can just go and print money willy-nilly when it suits them. So that idea that is not backed by anything is flawed.
Dominic Frisby there and Jemima Kelly. In the wake of the crypto carnage last week, the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told lawmakers that we really need a regulatory framework to guard against the risks. Joining me to discuss the issue of regulation or lack of it in the cryptosphere are David Schreier, Professor of Practice, AI and Innovation with Imperial College Business School, and Stephen Deal, a software engineer and writer on the subject of financial technology regulation. David Schreier, is there any meaningful regulation of cryptocurrency at the moment?
There is regulation around cryptocurrency, not only here in the UK, but across the Commonwealth and around the world. And it varies widely by country. So there remains some regulatory confusion.
What kind of regulation is there?
How is it being regulated really sort of varies on the use case. So you have cryptocurrencies that are used to raise capital to grow businesses. And you have other cryptocurrencies that are used to do things like make payments and do it less expensively.
Stephen, as you survey the pattern of regulation, what do you note?
There is some soft touch regulation, basically where crypto assets touch the existing financial system, where they have to comply with existing kind of like sanctions enforcement. But overwhelmingly, if you look at crypto assets, they're not generally regulated at the same level that, like, say, stocks on the London Stock Exchange are or the NASDAQ. The kind of protections that consumers have against fraud, against market manipulation, are basically non-existent here in the UK and in the United States at the moment. It's what the American regulators call like the Wild West. It's complete caveat emptor, just buyer beware.
In your opinion, does crypto need heavier regulation?
all markets need regulation because without regulation, there's a loss of trust in the infrastructure, other market participants, and in the assets themselves. And generally, when markets become regulated, large amounts of capital flow into the markets because people trust them anymore. When you have removed the trust, generally markets tend to have lots of disasters, panics, manias, and crashes. And that's not good for anybody involved.
David Schreier, is that your perception as well, which is that there's a requirement for regulation on cryptocurrencies? And if it is, can you just explain what the kind of hazards are that you would seek to regulate against?
You absolutely get a benefit from regulation. For example, you provide clarity to the financial institutions and innovators and technologists who are trying to create new kinds of financial securities or new kinds of technologies. You also provide for stability and risk management, which helps with stabilizing the financial system, attracting capital. So regulation, I think, is a good thing, but it needs to be prudent regulation. It is possible to overregulate. And a great example that is used as a cautionary tale is the New York State Bit License. So in the earlier days of the crypto revolution, New York State said, everyone who wants to do a cryptocurrency company needs to get a bit license. And oh, by the way, it will cost you $250,000. That had the adverse consequence of eliminating almost every startup from doing business in New York State. Because if you only raise $1 million to start your company, you can't spend $250,000 of it in a year getting your license from the state. So you want to avoid overregulation. You want to have prudent regulation that provides clarity, provides a clear path for innovators to engage with this area.
So, Stephen, what would be the specific things that you would seek to achieve through regulation, which if you didn't achieve them, could be negative?
Crypto assets, basically everything that you can buy today in the market, should be under a regulatory framework known as the securities framework. So this is a framework that was set in place after the Great Depression back in the 1930s, which regulates investments in common enterprises. So these are things like stocks, like bonds, derivatives. And so crypto assets are basically a form of security. And right now, they kind of exist outside of the regulatory boundary, which means that all of the protections that we've learned from the last 100 years, both here in Britain and the United States, no longer apply to them. And that means we get a lot of this kind of Wild West behavior and the kind of catastrophes and people losing all of their money that we saw back in the 1930s, right? That was a very bad time in financial markets. And so like what we're seeing right now is like basically they need to be brought back under the securities framework.
David Schreier, one of the great advantages of cryptocurrency, according to people who proselytize for it, is precisely that it doesn't have anything to do with government. Don't you undermine the very basis of the idea of cryptocurrency if you regulate it?
Well, first of all, there's a false perception that cryptocurrencies magically ignore the laws of gravity and exist outside of the real world. And that partly has to do with kind of the birth of Bitcoin, where there were a bunch of people in 2008 who, frankly, did not trust government or the financial system after the financial collapse and wanted to create something themselves. But the reality is, if you're going to move money into a cryptocurrency or out of a cryptocurrency from what people call fiat currencies like the pound or the dollar, you are engaged with the traditional or conventional financial system. So first of all, let's dispense with the myth that cryptocurrency exists in a parallel reality. There is no multiverse. We're all in the same universe here. And in that universe, there are laws that apply today, even if it's not a purpose-built cryptocurrency law. But the other thing to bear in mind is that, you know, the regulators themselves are struggling a little bit to grasp how to think about these things, because on some level, they see the benefits that cryptocurrency can deliver of reducing cost, improving access, improving transparency, improving speed, unlocking the $10 trillion of trapped capital that currently exists out there floating around when you try and move money across borders. I mean, these are just a few examples. But at the same time, as they try and grasp this, the regulators and policymakers are also reacting a little bit to headlines. And so like the crash last week, I fear will result in overregulation that is unnecessary.
Is that your view as well, Stephen?
No, I take a much more bleak view about these things. I think crypto assets are kind of much more like stocks. They behave as a kind of investment people looking to buy low and sell high to make a return in either dollars or pounds. So they're kind of what the Bank of England calls like a purely speculative asset. much like a stock is. And purely speculative assets come with a certain set of risks. When you buy a stock in a company, I don't know, like Apple or something, or like some other company, right? You're buying a share on the future cash flows of that enterprise, right? So Apple makes iPhones and they sell the iPhones for a profit and that money flows back into the enterprise, right? And that money ultimately gets redistributed to shareholders in the form of like stock buybacks or dividends. So with a crypto asset, it's like a stock, except there's no underlying business, there's no cash flows, there's no revenue, there's no product. It's basically just the financialization of nothingness. So you go over to the British Museum, there's this basically paper notes from the South Sea bubble, where people would basically like would fractionalize up shares in these kind of like common enterprises in foreign countries. And so the South Sea certificates are basically like the crypto assets of the 17th century all over again.
Now, I'm trying to get clear in my mind in that case what it is we're regulating against. Is it that too much money flows into an unsafe market in an unregulated way and its collapse brings the world down upon it? Is it the protection of people who buy into this market? Which of those is it, Steve?
Well, regulation is meant to protect market integrity and also like the retail public. Because, you know, the FCA in this country, the Financial Conduct Authority, warns that whenever you kind of invest in one of these assets, like there's no recourse to the government. You may lose all of your money when the asset basically goes to zero because they fall outside of the regulatory perimeter. And it's not entirely clear what the intrinsic value of one of these products actually is because there's no underlying business or company, right? It's basically a share of basically the financialization of nothingness. And that's the fundamental paradox of crypto assets and what makes them kind of rather pathological in the rest of financial markets because we don't really have other products like this.
David Schreier, is that your view as well? I mean, in other words, I suppose what I'm asking is there any particular benefit to the world from cryptocurrencies that is not more than offset by the potential dangers?
Yeah, so first of all, I have to gently augment or amplify the contention that there is no usefulness to these currencies and that they're purely speculative. There's been a democratization of access to capital that these cryptocurrencies have permitted that have allowed the funding of new innovative projects in geographies outside of Northern California. And so right there, there is a benefit to society because I will contend that there are many more innovators in the world than just in a 20 square mile radius around Sand Hill Road. Second of all, there are opportunities for different kinds of cryptocurrencies. So not all cryptocurrencies are created equal. And this differentiation is important in understanding them because it's kind of like saying the British pound is exactly identical to buying a penny stock on the London Stock Exchange, and therefore everything should be regulated the same. Actually, there's something much different in something that's being used as a currency than something that is being used as a speculative security or as a fundraising vehicle for a growth company. And so we do want to regulate in order to protect the interests of small shareholders who may lack the financial sophistication to understand these instruments, these financial securities. I think that someone like a Citadel or a Barclays have enough smart people who are educated about sophisticated financial instruments that they should be able to invest in these securities and they should be able to take risk, manage risk, but do it within a framework of clarity that the regulators need to provide.
I'm going to take you to the awful moment in a discussion like this, which is when I invite you to look into your crystal ball. David, where do you see cryptocurrency going in, let's say, the next decade?
The wonderful thing about being a futurist is that no one ever comes back and checks my last predictions. So I will boldly look forward and say, in the future, I think we're going to have a more harmonized international regulatory framework. We will have this new financial instrument, which will help in certain use cases with improving transparency and lowering costs. And there will be failures. And those things happen in any kind of financial system. Despite all of that hundreds of years of securities regulation, we still had Enron. We still had WorldCom, which were major stock collapses in highly regulated markets. And hopefully we've learned from some of those things and can apply those lessons in the realm of cryptocurrency.
Stephen Deal, independent of how we analyze the value of something like cryptocurrency, would you agree broadly that that is the outlook for it in the next decade?
No, I'm going to take a much more bleak perspective because I think the general public doesn't really need 19,000 different types of private money. In fact, we actually kind of experimented with that kind of setup in the United States way back in the late 1800s. It was called so-called wildcat banking era, where money was not issued by like the Treasury. It was issued by independent banks. And all of these banks had very different kind of investment characteristics, and the notes all had different faces on them, and they all had different notional values. And it just turns out that that introduces a lot of friction into commerce. People really just want to go and buy their coffee in the morning with a single like pound. And it doesn't seem to me that like what crypto is bringing to the table, except to bring us back to like the wildcat banking era.
Stephen Deal there, and David Schreier. And my conclusion? The world doesn't get any simpler for any of us. My thanks to Gavin Brown, Jemima Kelly, Dominic Frisby, David Schreier and Stephen Deal. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producer was Ben Carter and the editor was Richard Varden. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. And another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. If you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds.
Hi there, I'm just popping up to let you know about another Radio 4 podcast that you may be interested in. Especially if, like me, your social media feeds are constantly bombarding you with adverts that are hyping up the latest Wonder products, promising you the world. You know the ones, personalised vitamin plans to make you healthier, a pair of sustainable jeans to make you greener, NFTs to earn you millions. I am on a mission to find out the facts behind the fads. I'm Greg Foote, and my BBC Radio 4 podcast Sliced Bread is back to ask if another batch of these Wonder products really are the best thing since sliced bread. If you'd like to know about Manuka honey or mosquito repellent or mindfulness apps, or if you've got something you'd like me to investigate for you, just go search for Sliced Bread on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello. It's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.